Welcome to Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daryl Stranger. This week's guest is Bert Crowfoot, the CEO of the Aboriginal Multimedia Society of Alberta.
Okay. My name is Bert Crowfoot. I'm half Soto, half Blackfoot from Siksika First Nation in southern Alberta. My great-great-grandfather was Chief Crowfoot, who signed Treaty 7. I was also adopted by the Kwakwa people on Vancouver Island, and my Indian names are Kayustoa, which is Blackfoot for Bear Ghost, and Gayutalas, which is Kwakwa for Always Giving.
Bert, thank you for that. That's one thing that we really wanted to get to know you a little bit was I was hoping you would introduce yourself that way, and our audience, I'm sure, is going to appreciate that. And one of the reasons that we wanted to have you as our first guest on this new venture, like I said, Windspeaker Talks, you are such an interesting person, and you have such a cool story, and the amount of different media outlets and media opportunities you've done has been fantastic, and the work for Indigenous people has just been fantastic. So again, thank you for coming on. And you introduced yourself a little bit, but I wanted to get to know you a bit more. Who is Bert Crowfoot? How did you sort of get started in all of this?
My parents wanted to break the cycle that was happening on reserve. I was at residential school for day school for grades 1 and 2. Grade 3, I went to Carsland, which is a off-reserve community just west of our reserves. And grade 8, my parents wanted to break that cycle, so they sent us to live with non-Indigenous people, families, and go to school in the city. We left for school in September and didn't return till June. So we were away from our families for 10 months. It was part of the Mormon Church placement program. And it must have been successful because there's 22 college degrees in my siblings. There's 10 doctors in my siblings and their offspring. And so, but it came at a price. You know, your loss of family, your loss of connections, your disconnect from culture because you're living in a non-Indigenous home. Mm-hmm. And they were great people for the most part. Most of my family had good experiences. And that's how I got off the reserve. My sister, Amelia Crowfoot Clark, she was a very good advocate for education. She used to say that education is the new buffalo. And so I wasn't even out of high school yet, and she already had me accepted at Brigham Young University. I had my schooling, my education, my accommodation, my funding, everything was taken care of by her. Mm-hmm. She looked after all of that. So originally, when I went to school, I was in pre-med. I was having way too much fun and switched to physical education recreation. I always wanted to coach high school sports. And so BYU, I had access to the best coaches in the world. I had Lavelle Edwards, who was NCAA Coach of the Year. I went to Pee Wee Reese, who was a shortstop for the LA Dodgers. He was my baseball coach. And so I was very fortunate to have that caliber. When I first got out of school, I wasn't quite graduated and had about a semester left, and I decided to take a year off, bills to pay, young family. So I came back to Edmonton, and a friend of mine was the editor of the Native People newspaper, which was published by the Alberta Native Communications Society. So at that time, he asked me if I could freelance a sports story, basketball tournament down at Picani. And so I went down, covered that, took some photos, gave him everything, wrote the story. He liked it so much, he sent me down to Kainai to cover a basketball tournament. So I covered that, pictures and everything else, and then he hired me full-time. So when I first came back, I was a silversmith. I was making silver and turquoise jewelry, mm-hmm. making this jewelry, selling it to different vendors and stores and make some more. And so that was kind of how I generated some revenue. But I got into media, and it was exciting. I soon worked my way up to where I was the sports reporter, sports editor. And because I took a week of photography in high school in shop, industrial arts, I was thrown in a dark room, and they showed me how to develop film, so I started doing that and mm-hmm. got interested in photography. And so I was in a dark room writing stories, and they had a deficit of about $100,000+. And so it used to be 11 people in the newspaper, and they wouldn't replace them when people left. So pretty soon there was only 3.5 of us. And we hired a salesperson for the first time. And this guy started selling. And over the course of 8 months, we brought that deficit down. So we were even. We were in the black again, finally. And so at that time, the board changed. And they came in with some really strict guidelines. So you can't do this, can't do that. And
right.
I got a little frustrated. And I kind of told the board off. And I finally said, look, you guys are taking credit for bringing out deficit. And I said, you had nothing to do with it. If I can do it with a staff of three that used to be 11 people, I said, you still have a deficit. And so they didn't like that. So I got fired for the first time in my life. So we went to lunch with the guy who hired me. He got fired too. And the salesman, and what do we do now? And the sale guy says, well, whatever you decide, I like you guys, I'm in. So we started a newspaper in my basement called The Nation's Enzyme. And we went around, we sold advertising to it. We were 100% independent, and we did that for a while. I left for a little bit, and I put out a powwow publication called Powwow Trail. Sold the advertising, I did all the layout, I had it published, and then I went back, and things didn't work out with the partners, so I left. And the old place that fired me, Alberta Native Communications Society, they hired me back as the publisher. And I was only there for about 2 months, and federal government and provincial government pulled their funding.
Uh-huh.
And so there I was, all the staff. And so I put together a proposal, and then I approached them, and they got to know me for what I did over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, and they liked me, so I got approved for funding. I was 27 years old.
Wow.
And so I started AMHSA, and we started off with Windspeaker. 1986, we brought in the CFWE. It was our first. We had the opportunity to start with radio and television, but I decided that I'd rather start with one and make it strong, build a solid foundation, mm-hmm. then do the other rather than do two of them.
Yeah.
Not as good as developing one. So
yeah.
We didn't get into television, and pretty soon NNBAP, Northern Native Broadcast Access Program, cut funding, and we never did get into television. Right. So.
Well, and Bert, just before we get, I wanted to know more about the career aspect. I wanted to go back a little bit to the culture and leaving your culture for a little bit. Did you always stay connected to the culture in some way, even though you were gone for such a long time? Or how did you manage that as you were away from your community and from your family?
Well, we weren't part of the cultural side or the ceremonial side of the reserve. My family, my father was a hard worker. He was a trailblazer too, in that he was a farmer that went over and above, and the reserve and the Indian agent got frustrated with him always selling his grains. Finally, they just said, go ahead and do whatever you want. And so my father was doing that, and then he decided that when they quit giving him farmland, he went out and started breaking prairie and developing more farmland on his own. And so that was the example that I grew up with.
Yeah.
Both my parents were hard work ethic, and there was no such thing as you can't do it. They did it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, like I said, my brothers and sisters, same thing. We all have that work ethic. And so, but that was the kind of family that we had. We weren't really involved in the ceremonial side.
Okay.
Later, when I went to BYU, I started dancing powwow, men's fancy dance. I had two roommates. One was from, both of them were from Oklahoma. So I did the Southern men's fancy style.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came to Canada in the summer to dance up here, men's fancy was just starting to evolve here. Before, we just had the traditional men's traditional chicken dance and those types. We didn't have jingle or women's shawl or any of those types. We had a lot of the traditional ones. And mm-hmm. so at one powwow I used to make powwow whistles. And I remember going to a powwow in about 1983 at Powmakers, and there was 24 men's fancy dancers, and 12 of the bustles were made by the Small Boys Camp out in the Rocky Mountains. They were up there, and the other 12 I made. And over the course of the years, people started making their own and got fancier. Mine were pretty plain. But that was, like it says, the cultural side.
Yeah.
I was never really involved in the ceremonial side until I would go and I would attend ceremony, but it wasn't a lot of what I did back then.
Right. So was there a reason that you maybe wanted to get into that as you got older? Like you said, it wasn't until a bit later. What sort of made you want to explore that aspect of your life?
Well, when you said the ceremonial, it's the culture that when you're living with a non-native home, I can understand Blackfoot because my grandparents said it, but I didn't learn how to speak it.
Right. Okay.
My mother was from Soto, Plains Ojibwe, in Saskatchewan, from the Key Reserve. And my mother and my father had to speak to each other, so they spoke English.
Right.
So I grew up in an English-speaking house. Then I went away to school and I lived with non-Indigenous people, and so I never learned the language, right? My oldest sister did. Mm-hmm. And so getting back, when I started attending powwows, I was involved in a lot of the cultural side of things, but not the ceremonial side.
Well, and just getting back to your career, I mean, you started all the media aspect and, you know, just from a basketball tournament to now, it's pretty incredible. Over the years, what's sort of drawn you to do the work within media, whether that be photography or print journalism or photojournalism? Was there maybe one aspect of it throughout it all that sort of drew you to want to keep doing it?
Well, I've always been driven to not only do the best that I can, but to be the best.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that changed my life was my brother, Strader, gave me a set of motivational tapes. Back then you got a cassette of tapes and a little plastic thing.
Yeah, right,
You know, you list, there's 12 lessons and there are 6 tapes, one on each side. And he gave me this set of tapes called The Psychology of Winning by Dr. Dennis Waitley. And so I would drive around the north covering different events, going to different things, and I would have side one for a week, and then I'd flip it over and listen to side two for week two. So for 12 weeks, it just completely burned into my memory everything that was happening. And then coaching, you know. You see a lot of coaches that are just screaming at their players. And the first team I ever coached was my sister, who was older than me, and it was older women. They were playing basketball. So I came out of school, and I started screaming at them that first practice. And I tell you what, I learned right away that you don't scream at older Indigenous women because they put you right in your place.
Yeah.
So, and then listening to those tapes, it changed how I approached everything. So my whole attitude on seeing things and looking at opportunities, one of the things I learned when something bad happens, what's the lesson? What's the opportunity? In 1990, the federal government cut funding for all the Indigenous newspapers across Canada, 11 of them. They gave us 6 weeks to become independent, to become self-sufficient. And this was about mid-February, they told us. And so here I am thinking, okay, what's the lesson? What's the good thing that comes out of this losing funding, right? And people are shutting their doors. And then it kind of dawned on me, like, there's a void across Canada. Here's an opportunity. And so WinSpeaker went national in those 6 weeks.
Wow.
We used to publish 10,000 newspapers across Alberta. In Western Canada, we were slowly expanding.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent 10 copies to every band office, every Native Indigenous organization across Canada, government offices, and we sent out 25,000. And the other thing is, there's a certain way of thinking. A lot of people that receive funding, they think along the lines of government. Okay, I like to think along the lines of a business. So one of the things that happened about this time of year, mid-February, early March, is when government departments and those indigenous or organizations that receive government funding, they look at their budgets, and if they've got a surplus, they blow it because they don't want to lose it for the next fiscal year, right? So they dump their budgets. Well, we had started selling advertising right off the bat. We received funding from this, the NA's Native Communications funding from federal government. And they told me when we finished the year, the next fiscal year, they looked at our financial statements and they said, well, you've got a surplus. We have to cut that. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I spent your money. Mm-hmm. That's my money, our money, that we have the surplus. And they kind of looked and they agreed. And so they couldn't touch our money. So we make sure that we spend the government money, mm-hmm. but anything, if we have a surplus, then we save it for emergencies or whatever. Yeah, so when federal government cut funding in 1990, we had a $250,000 surplus that helped us become self-sufficient and carry it on.
Saved up from over the years.
Saved us from, yeah, from past surpluses, right. So that we had this extra money. So just changing how you look at things, as like I said, those tapes that my brother gave me changed my life. Because how I look at everything, it's when I see things, okay, I don't think of it as like government funding. I think like a business. And anything that comes up, I always look at, how can I monetize that? How can we make money from that? Mm-hmm. And if you look at this, some of the things that this organization's doing, community radio, you know, we built a community radio studio down the hall here. Mm-hmm. So there's an opportunity down the road to, I find that there's a lot of predators out there that are preying on our people.
Yes.
Like it's the equipment that costs, say, $100,000, they'll charge them $200,000. And so what I want to do is have them come in here. We've got a studio set up. This is what you get for $100,000. And then we tried to standardize that so that all any other communities that are getting to the same thing will have the same equipment. So right. One goes down, we can send out replacement parts as opposed to them going through their mm-hmm. consultant and, you know, getting taken advantage of to replace it, et cetera. So
right.
It's an opportunity. Yes, we'll make some money, but we're not going to take advantage of our people.
Yeah. Well, and just on the indigenous media landscape as a whole, why is that so important? Why is it important that we have organizations like this one and like on the television side, APTN for the news and ask, why is it so important that we do have indigenous outlets with indigenous voices, you know, telling the stories?
Well, that's the exact point. I mean, if you're listening to a non-indigenous person telling stories about our people, but they've never experienced any of the stuff
yeah.
that's gone on, it's really hard for them to understand mm-hmm. and to relay it. With us, with our organization, it's really hard to find trained, talented, indigenous people to look after all of those spots.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a person who worked here for many, many years, and he was non-indigenous. But you know what? There's three factors that I look at when I look at a person. Okay, first of all, you look at blood quantum, mm-hmm. you know, is he indigenous? Okay. A lot of times we can't find that indigenous person.
Yeah.
The second thing I look at is, are they indigenous here and are they indigenous up here? And if you lived and been with indigenous people for so long, you start understanding how they think. You start talking at them. You start pointing with your lips. You start
yeah.
doing a lot of things that indigenous people do. And
yeah.
people forget that, though, you're non-native, right? But they see you as a friend.
Absolutely.
And they talk to you. And that, to me, is one of the most important things, is that if you're going to work with us and you just happen to not have indigenous blood, you are indigenous, because a lot of times, you know, we end up adopting you, and that's a whole different side. You know, if you're adopted as, like, I like to think this organization is a big family, and everybody's really working together and helping each other out and
yeah.
helping each other to achieve.
And then just with that, as a media landscape as a whole, where Do you see this maybe changing again? I mean, the landscape is always changing, whether it be because of, you know, budget cuts or, you know, what people consume that media on. What are you maybe seeing as we come here? You started with paper, now we're in radio, and, you know, are you what are you looking at? What are you seeing when it comes to the landscape of media? And the journalism that comes along with that as well.
Well, because we started in newspaper, one of the things I'm most proud of is that we, when it came to journalism, okay, with a lot of indigenous media, there's a lot of activists who say they're journalists, and there's a lot of journalists that are out there, not as many as there is activists.
Right.
You know, you got indigenous people who want to save the world, and they'll tell the stories the way it is, right? And to me, that's not what we're about. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to provide the information to our listeners, to our readers, that is balanced, unbiased, objective. Here's all the information, make up your own mind. Mm-hmm. And that's always been one of the things that we strive for. Here's the information. We're not telling you, you know, this guy's a bad guy, you know, and you're not slanting your news that way. And so even today, you see a lot of journalists that are activists.
Yeah.
Now, we need activists, okay, but not in journalism.
Yeah.
You know, we need those activists out there. They're important. They're those people that get things done.
Mm-hmm.
But we need journalists who tell the objective, balanced stories.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's been one of the foundations that I believe in. Mm-hmm. So the second thing is become self-sufficient.
Yeah.
I used to go down to the Native American Journal Association in the States. And they always used to complain about freedom of the press in Indian country.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to sit on a panel in 1996 in Atlanta, Georgia, and freedom of the press in Indian country. And topic came up, and I said, my turn came to speak. And I said, you really want freedom of the press in Indian country? Then own your own newspapers. Most of them worked for tribal papers who were funded by the chief and council or whoever, mm-hmm. and they controlled the content of the media, right? You can't be criticizing the people that pay your bills, right?
Yeah.
Or pay your salary. And so, but people wanted that freedom. And I said, you know, if you really want freedom, start your own newspapers. But nobody wanted to start their own newspapers. They would rather just sit there and complain.
Yeah.
And so we started our own newspapers. And I remember speaking with the Minister of Indian Affairs one time in Calgary. And everybody was, all these reporters were given 10 minutes with him. And I went in, sat down with him. He says, okay, what do you want? What questions do you have? And I said to him, well, I'm the publisher. I'm not the reporter. So, so we just started visiting. And then he stopped and he said, you know what? He says, I got to tell you. He said, you have hammered the heck out of me over all the years.
Yeah.
But you've also hammered the heck out of indigenous leaders.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you hit me hard, but you were objective. You weren't, like, it wasn't vindictive.
Yeah.
You were objective. And I respect that. And for the Minister of Indian Affairs to tell you that respects you for hard-hitting journalism, then you know you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You're on the right path.
Absolutely. And another good point from you is it just made me think of, like, our role as storytellers and not story takers. That was something I took away, especially, you know, throughout the years. And you make a really good point there.
We'll just expand on that. If you look in our radio studios, there's indigenous people on the walls.
Yeah.
There's pictures of teepees, and just our way of life is on those walls. And so I put those in there for a reason. One is that our studios are our lodges, is what I say. And those pictures are up to remind people on air who they're talking to. There's the elders, there's the little young people, there's adults, you know, just try to have different looks, entertainers and that. And that's who you're talking to. And to me, I'm most proud when I hear our listeners say, I mean, they just love some of our hosts, and, you know, they're laughing away and everything else. I mean, that's Indian people, you know, humor, laughing. So it makes me feel really good when I see our on-air hosts doing that, you know, interacting with people, making them laugh,
And Bert, maybe we'll end the interview with this question. Is what else would you still like to accomplish, whether that be personally, professionally? Is there something you haven't maybe checked off one of your lists yet?
One of the things when we lost our funding was I swore that we would never rely on government funding again. One of the things I learned right off the bat is diversify your revenue streams. Mm-hmm. We bought this building about 25 years ago for $589,000. It's now worth $7 million. We have a number of tenants in here that rent from us. So that generates about $250,000, $300,000 a year. Mm-hmm. We have a total budget of around just under $6 million. And 300 and some of that is government funding. The rest is all self-generated. Our radio bingo brings in about $4.5 million, $5 million a year. We're restricted on what we can use that money for. And we've set up a network of 100,000 watt transmitters across Alberta. Mm-hmm. So we have 10 of them now. Last March the 7th, in Medicine Hat, I flipped the switch, and that was our 1 million tenth transmitter. And I had a T-shirt that said 1 million watts of Indigenous power.
Something maybe for yourself, Bert, that you'd still maybe skydiving. You want to skydive or something like that? You know,
I have trouble walking up the stairs. No, skydiving is not one of them. But you know, people have asked me to put out a book for photography. Mm-hmm. Thinking about that. People have asked, you know, so I don't know, just yeah. I'm so focused on all this other stuff. And but one of the gifts that I have is when somebody says anything, all of a sudden I'm seeing opportunities,
right,
there
immediately,
and
yeah.
all of a sudden I'm starting to, you know, expand of stuff that we can work on. And yeah. but you need a crew, you need a team in order to accomplish that, you know. Right now I'm just a coach, I'm just you know, the guy that kind of, you know, Daryl do this, Tristan do that, and, you know, so that Daniel's got to do this. So, you know, we'll accomplish it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really well said, Bert, and I think we can leave it there. So, again, I just want to say thank you, Ken Askelmuthen, for coming and sharing a bit of your story with our audience, who I think they're going to gain such valuable experience from this, and you know, get to learn a bit about who you are, such an incredible person and leader. And you know, we're all very fortunate to have you here with us. So again, thank you, Ken Askelmuthen.
Okay, thank you.